I'm Lise Doucette from the BBC World Service. I've been reporting from Afghanistan for more than 30 years. The Americans are now out, the Taliban in. How did we get here? What happens next? Our podcast, A Wish for Afghanistan, may be able to help. Search for A Wish for Afghanistan wherever you get your podcasts.
Previously on Bad Cops. An elite unit of police officers has gone rogue in the city of Baltimore. They're called the Gun Trace Task Force, and their leader is Sergeant Wayne Jenkins. Their job is to get illegal weapons off the streets. But these officers have also been stealing money and drugs, planting evidence, and framing people. The FBI has been on their tail for months, using secret wiretaps to build their case against the squad. A federal SWAT team finally arrests the officers in an elaborate takedown with the Baltimore Police Department.
I was probably 5 or 6 feet away from Wayne Jenkins, and I stared him right in the eye, and he looked right back at me, right through me, as if to say, F you.
As news of the arrest spreads, some of the victims of the task force catch it on TV.
His face popped up, and I said, that's him. That's the guy that took my money. You know, this guy was working under Baltimore City for years. Nobody, you know, believed me.
And as the cops start turning on each other, the prosecution learns of an incident years earlier when heroin was planted in a man's car. Another officer is set to testify about what really happened that day. But he's found shot to death in a West Baltimore alley. There's a frenzy of speculation.
He was killed the day before he was scheduled to testify in a case against indicted Baltimore officers.
I'm Jessica Lussenhop, and this is Bad Cops from the BBC World Service. The true story of Baltimore's Gun Trace Task Force. Part 6, The Fallout. It's November 15th, 2017. Hours before he's shot, Detective Sean Suter and his partner are out driving in an area of West Baltimore. Suddenly, Suter tells his partner to pull over. He's just seen a suspicious-looking man in a black and white jacket loitering near an alleyway, and he wants to check him out. He tells his colleague to circle around to the other end of the alley to see if they can flush him out. They split up. As the partner's walking around the block, he hears Suter shouting, "Stop, police." Then, three gunshots.
Signal 13, signal 13. Call reporting that the partner got shot.
Police backup quickly arrives, but it's a chaotic scene.
We do not know where the shot came from. We have officers in bad locations.
Detective Suter is found face down in a dusty, vacant lot with a single gunshot wound to the head. He's rushed to the hospital, but it's too late.
Good afternoon. Just after noon today, 18-year veteran homicide detective Sean Suter was pronounced dead. 43 years old, married.
There's no video of the suspect, only a vague description from Police Commissioner Kevin Davis.
He is only described as an adult African-American male wearing a black jacket with a white stripe on the black jacket.
The police response is overwhelming. They flood the area with cops. They block off all the streets. Residents are even barred from returning to their own homes. Suter had been set to testify before a grand jury about Sergeant Wayne Jenkins, the leader of the Gun Trace Task Force. He was due to give his account of a fatal car crash involving Jenkins 7 years before. An elderly man named Elbert Davis was killed. And another driver was sent to prison over 32 grams of heroin found in his car at the scene of the wreck. That driver, Umar Burley, always insisted Jenkins and his crew planted the heroin. And now that Jenkins and the rest of the task force have been arrested, prosecutors believe him. But there's an argument about who planted those drugs. Was it Jenkins or one of the other detectives at the scene that day? One of them, was Detective Sean Suter. Suter's appearance in front of the grand jury was meant to determine what really happened. But Suter never makes it to the grand jury. No one will ever hear what he was going to say. The city of Baltimore is gripped with conspiracy theories. There are even claims this was a professional hit, that someone in the police department wanted Suter silenced. But details trickling out of the investigation into his death begin to paint a more complicated picture. Despite a massive manhunt, the suspect in the shooting, a black man in a black jacket, never materializes. And then there's Suter's gun. It's determined to be the weapon that killed him. The Baltimore Police Department orders an independent inquiry. The panel's conclusion is shocking and controversial.
An independent review board finds Baltimore Police Detective Sean Suter likely committed suicide. In a detailed report released last night, the board cited...
The report says that Suter staged his death to look like a murder. It says he couldn't face whatever he was about to say on that witness stand. They call his death a final act of quiet desperation.
There are a lot of you out there who refuse to believe this. Others think there's more to this about what we should know. But for
Sean Suter's widow, Nicole, issues her own statement.
My husband did not commit suicide. I will not accept the untimely death of Sean as nothing other than a murder, which is being covered up for reasons unknown to me or my family.
Sean Suter's death remains incredibly divisive. So far, no evidence has come to light that settles, once and for all, the question of what happened in that vacant lot. His death remains an open investigation. This mystery hangs heavy over the city as the trial of the Gun Trace Task Force draws closer. Bail bondsman and convicted cocaine dealer Donnie Stepp has been in a secret partnership with Sergeant Wayne Jenkins for years, selling drugs that Jenkins was stealing from work. But ever since he saw a handcuffed Jenkins being marched out of internal affairs on TV, he's been sweating.
I'm looking at the window, looking for the FBI. I'm saying to myself, how aren't they here?
Stepp's already read the indictments against the task force, and he's been trying to get anything incriminating out of his house. And it's not just drugs that he's worried about. Jenkins also sold him a few high-end wristwatches, part of the proceeds from the robberies.
There was one watch in particular once I read the indictment. That watch really bothered me. I didn't want to get caught with that watch. I lived on a waterfront property at a long pier in the back that went across the Chesapeake Bay. I went to the end of that pier and threw that watch.
One evening, just after midnight, Donnie steps in his kitchen.
My daughter's asleep upstairs, and the door exploded, and in comes the FBI and Baltimore County undercover narcotics officers. So there they was.
At the time of the Gun Trace Task Force takedown, Donnie Stepp wasn't even on the FBI radar. But once the feds come crashing through his door, Donnie starts to think his old friend has been ratting him out.
He drew first blood. As Rambo says now, you drew first blood and here we go. Now we're going to burn it down. And that's what I did.
Stepp flips on Jenkins. And when he does, he's all in. He turns over the photos and video he's taken of Jenkins during their crime spree. He even tells the FBI where to find certain drugs that they'd missed while searching his house. And he also shows them where they can find that high-end wristwatch he threw off the pier months earlier.
They wanted that watch because they thought that it was a part of a major robbery. I didn't think the FBI would find it. You know, they come right around Christmas time. It was very embarrassing. The neighbors and stuff, they're probably thinking they're looking for dead bodies under my pier. They come up. It took them 4 or 5 hours, but they found that watch.
When the investigators check the serial number, they realize it belongs to Ronald Hamilton, one of the Gun Trace Task Force robbery victims. the once united front of the Gun Trace Task Force crumbles. One by one, four of the detectives, among them Jamel Ram and Momodou Gondo, agree to admit to their crimes. They plead guilty. Wayne Jenkins has been holding out until Donnie Stepps starts telling the FBI everything he knows. With just 2 weeks to go before trial, Jenkins finally pleads guilty. But two of the officers from the unit deny the charges against them, which means the case will go to trial. The crimes of the Gun Trace Task Force will be discussed in open court, and police officers will testify against their former brothers in blue. The trial begins on a weirdly warm January day in 2018. It's taking place in the federal courthouse, a tall, blank-looking building near downtown Baltimore. I'm there covering the trial for the BBC, sitting in the gallery with the other reporters, just a few rows from the families of the officers. The first witness is one of the task force detectives, Maurice Ward. In court, he's wearing a green prison jumpsuit and a long dark beard. He tells the jury how the squad would regularly steal cash from people, how they carried BB guns to plant if they ever injured or killed someone. But it's when former detective Jamel Ram takes the stand that one of the biggest mysteries of the case is resolved. The investigation into the Gun Trace Task Force was sparked by the discovery of a mysterious GPS tracker. It was found under the car of a drug dealer in suburban Baltimore. On the witness stand, Ram admits that he put the GPS tracker on the dealer's car to track his movements so he could rob him when he wasn't home. Then he kicked the guy's door down, with Gondo outside as lookout, stole his heroin and a gun, and sold it all back on the street. Disgraced detective Jamel Ram is an emotional witness. On the stand, he retells the night of the car accident caused by the squad, the one they fled without stopping. Federal trials are not recorded. This is from Ram's transcript.
It was bad. I mean, none of us stopped to render aid or see if anyone was hurt, and it could have been any of us. It could have been any of your guys or my mother or father, but we just didn't stop.
The jury hears from Donald Stepp, Wayne Jenkins' one-time drug partner. And it also hears from around a dozen of the squad's victims. Several of them admit to selling drugs at the time of their arrests. It's a strange scene, watching self-confessed drug dealers testifying against sworn police officers. It's like the whole system's been turned on its head. And something else stands out, too. All but one of the victims who testify are Black. And they're not all tied to the drug trade. Some are regular working people, just trying to get by. And the officers robbed them anyway. One man was even homeless at the time. Most of them never bothered to complain because they thought no one would believe them. There's one moment of the trial that really stands out. It's when former drug dealer Ronald Hamilton is called to testify. He was living in a mansion in the Baltimore suburbs when the task force officers robbed him of $20,000. Defense lawyers needle him about his $500,000 house. How can someone who's just gotten out of prison for drugs afford this? Ronald Hamilton just loses it.
This destroyed my whole family. I am in a divorce process right now because of this. This destroyed my whole family, man. You sit here asking me questions about a house. Everybody's life is destroyed, man. My house don't have nothing to do with this.
It's a breathless trial. The jury never hears from former Sergeant Wayne Jenkins, but he's the star of the whole thing. After 3 weeks of testimony, the prosecution rests its case. The jury deliberates for 12 hours before returning with the verdict. Former detectives Daniel Hersel and Marcus Taylor, the two officers from the squad who have always maintained their innocence, are found guilty of racketeering and robbery. They're later sentenced to 18 years. Over the next several months, the four officers who testified against their former colleagues are sentenced. Jamel Rayum, 12 years. Momodou Gondo, 10 years. Maurice Ward and Evodio Hendricks, 7 years. But it's the sentencing of Wayne Jenkins that I'm really waiting for. When the day finally arrives, the courtroom is even more packed than usual. The Jenkins family is there. Also there are the children of Elbert Davis, the 86-year-old man who died in the car wreck caused by Jenkins and other officers in 2010. This is Jenkins' last opportunity to appeal to the judge before he's sentenced. I have no idea what to expect. Will he be remorseful or stone-faced? When he enters the courtroom, the swaggering super cop is gone. His eyes are red. He's sniffling. Then he rises to address the court. This is from the transcript.
To the Davises who lost their loved one, from the bottom of my heart, I wish I could take that day back and not stop that vehicle.
He apologizes to everyone, his wife, his parents. He claims to have found religion. He's read the Bible 31 times since getting locked up. He's almost sobbing. Jenkins then addresses Umar Burley, the man behind the wheel of the other car, who is not in the courtroom that day.
Mr. Umar Burley, God forgive me. I wish I could have came clean when I found out that drugs were planted. I should have came clean and I didn't. I'm so sorry, Your Honor.
He collapses into his seat. Moments later, the judge sentences him to 25 years in a federal prison. He's scheduled for release in 2038. I remember how the end of the trial felt incredibly unsatisfying. Sure, 7 officers were heading to prison, but it felt like we'd gotten just the tiniest glimpse into what was really going on inside the Baltimore Police Department. More than a dozen names of other Baltimore officers and supervisors came up during the trial, some of them alleged to be accomplices in robberies. At one point, a very senior officer was named in testimony. Later the same day, that officer announced his retirement. The department promised to investigate all of this. FBI agent Jensen had a similar feeling to mine, that this case was far from over.
We didn't have time to catch our breath. We had all this information. What do we do with it? We can't just put it in an FBI file and stick it in a drawer somewhere. I mean, we all agreed, and I can remember very specifically that we all sat around and said, we got to try. We have to try to figure out if we can corroborate everything that we're told about the conduct of either other officers or other people that were involved in this case.
Because of the ongoing investigation, a total of 20 Baltimore police officers have now been charged. There were thousands of criminal cases involving the Gun Trace Task Force that needed to be re-examined. Investigators wanted to know if the cases were tainted by any of the corruption revealed at the trial. Ultimately, 800 cases were thrown out. Dozens sued the Baltimore Police Department. So far, the city has paid out $14 million. One of those who sued was Kenneth Baumgardner. He had his jaw fractured after an encounter with the Gun Trace Task Force and was eventually awarded $150,000.
I'm finally, like, trying to get my life back on track. It's still hard, though, because I get a lot of pain in my mouth and, like, you know, I'm losing a lot of teeth. You know, they used to be nice and pretty. Most of the back teeth are gone because of the injury. Like, all my teeth in the act are, like, gone, you know. So I'm just dealing with that. But for the main part, I'm staying focused and happy and moving forward, you know.
Some had their convictions overturned, like Umar Burley. Burley had 32 grams of heroin planted on him after a fatal car crash, and he served 7 years in prison because of it. In court, the judge who ordered Burley's release was the same judge who accepted his false plea years earlier. Umar Burley told me what it felt like that day, to be believed by the court.
Judge Bennett said that I am the one that sentenced you, so I feel partly responsible for these actions. So he come down off the bench and said he wanted to shake my hand and apologize. And, you know, it made me feel good to get the situation out. I felt like finally something is being done.
Umar Burley sued the police department. In late 2020, the city of Baltimore settled with him for $8 million. This could have been the start of a new life for Burley. But it didn't turn out that way.
A man who Baltimore City just paid millions to as part of the settlement in the Gun Trace Task Force scandal has been arrested for attempted murder. Umar Burley is accused of shooting a woman at a Motel 6 in Harrisonburg, Virginia. He was arrested this morning and is charged with attempted murder.
Burley is now sitting in jail in Virginia, awaiting trial on charges of attempted murder for shooting his girlfriend and for shooting at police during a high-speed chase. This baffling crime allegedly all happened within days of the first $1 million landing in his bank account. Over the last 4 years, the biggest question in my mind has always been this. How do you go from a rookie cop who swore an oath to serve and protect the citizens of Baltimore to being part of a corrupt criminal gang? I've written to all 7 officers who were originally charged, asking them to talk to me. Tell me how it happened. When was the first time they stole? Did someone show them, this is the way we do things in plainclothes police? Did the top brass knowingly turn a blind eye? Only one officer wanted to engage, Marcus Taylor. He was one of the 2 officers who went to trial. But he denied any wrongdoing. In one of his emails to me, he wrote, "I maintain my innocence and I always document everything. My life is about protecting and serving the citizens of Baltimore and reducing the violence in the city. I love Baltimore." I also wrote to former Sergeant Wayne Jenkins many times. But if I'm being honest, I never expected him to talk to me. Since the case broke 4 years ago, he hasn't given a single interview. But then, something sort of crazy happened. Just as I was finishing putting this story together.
You have a prepaid call. You will not be charged for this call. This call is from
Wayne Jenkins,
an inmate at a federal prison.
That's next time. You've been listening to Bad Cops from the BBC World Service with me, Jessica Lussenhop. The program was mixed by Neil Churchill, additional mixing by James Beard. The producer is Ben Crichton, and the editor is Richard Varden.
My name's Lise Doucette.
February 13th, 1989. From my window, I can see the whole war in Kabul unfolding.
Well, my voice has changed a little bit over the years, but I'm still reporting on Afghanistan. We put together a podcast. It was much harder than we thought. It kept changing because Afghanistan kept changing with breathtaking speed. Lives turned inside out. In our 10 episodes, you'll hear stories from remarkable people whose lives have shaped events in Afghanistan, and events have shaped them.
Mr. President, sometimes you said one thing in the morning and another thing in the evening.
No, I was a decisive president. That's exactly what they didn't want.
And now that this story is making headlines everywhere, you may be asking, what happens next? What happened before? I know I do. And these people can help us.
I really did think that we will achieve peace and war will end.
A Wish for Afghanistan from the BBC World Service. Search for A Wish for Afghanistan wherever you get your podcasts.